This week we're moving on to Lawrence, D.H. Lawrence. D.H. Lawrence, that sex-obsessed maniac, that frenzied little Englishman with a blood mystique. Yes, Lawrence, because Lawrence is something which whole squads of poet citizens, unblemished by mania or mystique, don't have and can't get. What is it? Something, don't let's be in too much of a hurry to put a name on it, something that comes across in fragments like these from Lawrence's letters. I'll just read these fragments like so many preludes. Here, for example, he's writing from Scotland. There is something up here in among the islands and the silent lochs, like the twilight morning of the world, the herons fishing undisturbed by the water, and a sea running far in for miles between the wet, trickling hills. Again, oh, it is good. There are no more Englands, no nations, only the dark, strong rocks and a strong sea washing up out of the dawn of the sky. It is the beginning only. It's that beginning thing which is so much a part integral of these explorations we're making. And here you have in this other section, physicality, sheer physical presence in the world, rising up into other dimensions. There is something beyond, like this sea traveling in from the unknown, and the gulls that cry sharply in the air. And you also have a move away from what Nietzsche called the human all too human, as in this excerpt, damn humanity. Let me have a bit of inhuman or non-human truth that our fuzzy human emotions can't alter. So how to get at this fresh thing? What's the way to it? What's the method? He says in a letter, it is a matter of underground development, development of new being in the roots of life, not only in the head. What we want is the fulfillment of our desires, down to the deepest and most spiritual desire. And I shall find my deepest desire to be a wish for pure, unadulterated relationship with the universe. With regard to society, what he wanted was, what he said, a new crystallization. If only in the dirty solution of this world, some new little crystal will begin to form. All this concentrated in his poems, in his poetry. D.H. Lawrence is mostly known for his novels, but for me, his poems and his essays and certain prose pieces which are hard to define, like Etruscan places, are more important than the novels. Well, who is this D.H. Lawrence with these radical desires and this radical movement? He was born 1885 in Nottinghamshire, in England, into a miner's family. 1897, he was at Nottingham High School. 1903, he studied as a pupil teacher at a school near Eastwood. 1906, he was at Nottingham University College. And by 1908, he was teaching at a school near London in Croydon. 1909, his first poems are published in the English Review, and in 1911, his first novel is published, called The White Peacock. In 1912, he met the woman he was going to live with for the rest of his life, Frieda Weekly. She was married to someone else at the time. This was a woman of German origin. And they finally left for Germany that year, 1912, living first in the Tyrol, and then later moving down to Italy. 1913, they were settled near Verona, a place called San Gaudenzo, and they returned to England. Lawrence's life is largely going to be a move all over the world with sporadic returns to his native country. 1913 also saw the publication of one of his most famous novels, Sons and Lovers, which is largely autobiographical, situation of a man between his mother and the woman he's in love with at the century's turning. 1915, another book appears called The Rainbow, which is one of the first books of Lawrence to meet up with censor difficulties. Legal problems arose around his books, considered as immoral. 1915, he also has the project of a community, which he calls Rhenanim, R-E-N-A-N-I-M, Rhenanim, a community of like minds, of elective affinities. 1916, he and his wife, Frieda, settle in Cornwall. Cornwall, sort of part of England's wilder country. In 1916, that same year, he publishes a book on Italy, or concerning his experiences in Italy, called Twilight in Italy. 1917, the Lawrences are expulsed from Cornwall because the military authorities heard him speaking German with his German wife, Frieda, and heard him singing German songs. So he was expulsed, which made him rather dislike English authoritarianism. He moved first of all to London and then up to Berkshire. 1919, at the end of the war, the Lawrences are able to leave, and they leave for Italy. 1920, they're in Taormina. And that year, another famous novel appears, Women in Love, the theme of the couple, which is very strong in his books. 1921, he's traveling in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and Italy. Until that same year, later in that same year, he's invited to New Mexico. His first experience of America is invited to New Mexico by Mabel Dodge Lewin. In that same year, he publishes one of his essays called Psychoanalysis and the Unconscious, a kind of unorthodox view of psychoanalysis. 1922, he and his wife leave for Ceylon, and then later settle for a while in New Mexico at Taos. In that same year, 1922, he publishes Fantasia of the Unconscious, to which I'll refer later on. 1923, New Mexico, contacts with the Indians of New Mexico. Publication of a book that should be read by every Americanist, which is called Studies in Classic American Literature, studies on Franklin, Fenimore Cooper, Edgar Allan Poe, Hawthorne, Melville, Whitman. 1924, after Frieda had left him in New Mexico and got back to London on her own, he moves through Germany and France, then goes back to New Mexico, until in 1925, he comes back definitively to Europe, already a sick man suffering from tuberculosis. 1926, he's living in Florence in Italy, and that year, another well-known novel appears called The Plumed Serpent, concerning Mexico, concerning the establishment of a religious community in New Mexico. 1927, he's in Etruria, which is going to give rise to his book, Etruscan Places. 1928, he's in Switzerland, trying to recover his health. Then in Porco, down in the south of France, and in Bandol. In that year, 1928, his most notorious novel appears, and that is Lady Chatterley's Lover, a criticism of industrial society, and to some extent at least a kind of hymn to sex, which is again meant that he met up with legal difficulties. 1929, he's in Majorca, and his paintings are shown in London. He also did painting. Travels 1929 in Italy and in Germany, and ends up in Bandol in the south of France. That year, 1929, his poems appear under the title of Pansies. Pansies, pansy in English, is a flower, but into this word you must also read the idea of pensée. His poems are to be considered as flowers of thought. We'll go into that later. Flowers of thought, that's a poem for him. 1930, he enters a sanatorium at Vence, and he leaves that sanatorium shortly, only to die on the 2nd of March, 1930, in Vence. That then is simply a fast run through the man's life so that you can situate his career. But let's move now into his thought, into his poetic thinking, into his thoughtful poetry. Fundamentally, I think I see Lawrence as an example of homo religiosus. There is a religious thing in Lawrence. He is a religious man, put the word in inverted commas, a religious man of an archaic type. Or if the word religion seems to use, it seems to me a kind of dead word, then call it sun moon yoga. Sun moon yoga or mind physics. And this comes across, this religious thing, this cosmic religious thing, comes across in this text of D.H. Lawrence's, which to me is one of the most beautiful. He speaks of that vast old religion, greater than anything we know, more starkly and nakedly religious. The whole life effort of man was to get his life into contact with the elemental life of the cosmos, mountain life, cloud life, thunder life, air life, earth life, sun life. Immediate felt contact, sheer, naked contact. And this word contact is probably the key word for D.H. Lawrence. It's this contact that comes across, this desire for contact, that comes across in a poem like Terra Incognita, which I'll now read, Terra Incognita. Remember that his poems are called Flowers of Thought, Pansies, Pensées. They consist of a man speaking out, no complicated syntax, simple statements. We'll speak later of the poetics. Let's just read this poem, Terra Incognita. There are vast realms of consciousness still undreamed of, vast ranges of experience like the humming of unseen harps we know nothing of within us. Oh, when man escapes from the barbed wire entanglement of his own ideas and his own mechanical devices, there is a marvelous rich world of contact and sheer fluid beauty and fearless face-to-face of now naked life and me and you and other men and women and grapes and gulls and ghosts and green moonlight and ruddy orange limbs stirring the limbo of the unknown air and eyes so soft, softer than the space between the stars. And all things and nothing and being and not being alternately palpitant. When at last we escape the barbed wire enclosure of know thyself, knowing we can never know, we can but touch and wonder and ponder and make our effort and dangle in a last fastidious fine delight, as the fuchsia does, dangling her reckless drop of purple after so much putting forth and slow mounting marvel of a little tree. So there is this terra incognita with which we can make an attempt to get in touch. If you look at the poem Bare Almond Trees, you have a particular instance of this kind of encounter. You have Lawrence, if you like, trying to get inside this almond tree, coming at it again and again, obsessively. Bare almond trees. Wet almond trees in the rain. Like iron sticking grimly out of earth. Black almond trunks in the rain. Like iron implements twisted hideous out of the earth. Out of the deep soft fledge of Sicilian winter green. Earth, grass, uneatable. Almond trunks curving blackly, iron dark, climbing the slopes. Almond tree beneath the terrace rail, black, rusted iron trunk. You have welded your thin stems finer like steel, like sensitive steel in the air. Grey lavender, sensitive steel, curving thinly and brittly up in a parabola. What are you doing in a December rain? Have you a strange electric sensitiveness in your steel tips? Do you feel the air for electric influences like some strange magnetic apparatus? Do you take in messages in some strange code from heaven's wolfish, wandering electricity that prowls so constantly around Etna? Do you take the whisper of sulfur from the air? Do you hear the chemical accents of the sun? Do you telephone the roar of waters over the earth, and from all this do you make calculations? Sicily, December Sicily in a mass of rain, with iron branching blackly, rusted like old twisted implements, and brandishing and stooping over Earth's wintry fledge, climbing the slopes of uneatable soft green. In the essay, Fantasia of the Unconscious, Lawrence has this phrase that more or less sums up this poem. He speaks of the deep satisfaction lies not in escaping, but in getting into the perfect circuit, the circuit of the Earth's terrestrial magnetism. What he's after is a kind of magnetic physicality or physical magnetism. It's not at all easy to talk about Lawrence's ideas, about Lawrence's philosophy, as he called it himself, simply because he's so fluid and so contradictory at times. Sometimes, too, I would say, he's just a cantankerous little devil with the tantrums, talking sheer balderdash. That happens. But there's a lot to be got at in there, and I think the best approach to it is a phrase by Lawrence himself in his studies in classic American literature, when he says this, concerning the readings which perhaps certain Roman patricians made of the new writing surging up in Rome, in the latter days of Rome. One wonders, he says, what the proper highbrow Roman of the 3rd and 4th or later centuries read into the strange utterances of Lucretius or Apuleius or Tertullian, Augustine or Athanasius. The uncanny voice of Iberian Spain, the weirdness of old Carthage, the passion of Libya and North Africa. You may bet the proper old Romans never heard them at all. It is hard to hear a new voice, as hard as it is to listen to an unknown language. Around what he was thinking, Lawrence saw building up a host of caricatures, cliches, false and narrow interpretations, which happens to any radical writer. And it was because he felt he was being read, or wasn't being read the way he should, that he was being read wrongly, that D.H. Lawrence began to try and read himself. And he began to write his essay books, his think tank books. And he says this in Fantasia of the Unconscious, which is one of these books. He speaks of this pseudo-philosophy of mine. Polyanalytics, as one of my respected critics might say, is deduced from the novels and poems, not the reverse. He draws it out from the novels and the poems. The novels and poems come unwatched out of one's pen. And then there's the absolute need which one has for some sort of satisfactory mental attitude towards oneself and things in general. This makes one try to abstract some definite conclusions from one's experiences as a writer, as a man. So we can't expect from Lawrence any kind of systematic philosophy, any kind of systematic science, but we have a kind of thinking and a kind of knowledge. Don't let's forget that he called his poems pansies, pensées. One of his poems is entitled Thought, and here's his type of thinking, his approach to thought. Thought, I love thought, but not the juggling and twisting of already existent ideas. I despise that self-important game. Thought is the welling up of unknown life into consciousness. Thought is the testing of statements on the touchstone of the conscience. Thought is gazing on the face of life and reading what one can read. Thought is pondering over experience and coming to conclusion. Thought is not a trick or an exercise or a set of dodges. Thought is man in his wholeness, wholly attending. Man in his wholeness, wholly attending, insist on the phrase. Lawrence, at one point, couldn't accept to be catalogued simply as a poet with all the limited connotations that word sometimes carries with it, or as a novelist with all the banal connotations that that can carry with it, nor as a writer. I mean, there are so many writers. T.S. Eliot, another poet, almost at the same time, said, the poetry does not matter. In other words, in a poem, there's something more important than the poetry. Well, the poetry does matter, but there is this other thing, which is, to put initial words on it, thought, vision, or world image. And Lawrence himself says in the Fantasia, Fantasia of the Unconscious, art is utterly dependent on philosophy, or if you prefer it, on a metaphysic. The metaphysic or philosophy may not be anywhere very accurately stated and may be quite unconscious in the artist, yet it is a metaphysic that governs men at the time. and is by all men more or less comprehended and lived. Men live and see according to some gradually developing and gradually withering vision. This vision exists also as a dynamic idea or metaphysics, exists first as such. Then it is unfolded into life and art. Our vision, our belief in this modern age, our metaphysic is wearing woefully thin, and the art is wearing absolutely threadbare. You see, I'm looking for a vocabulary, philosophy, metaphysics. In the Fantasia, he says, I believe I am only trying to stammer out the first terms of a forgotten knowledge. I believe I am only trying to stammer out the first terms of a forgotten knowledge. And he looks for vocabulary to symbols, myths, mystic figures, or cosmic graphs. Maybe what he's after is not so much a metaphysic or a philosophy as a cosmology. Maybe what he's after is what I would like to call a cosmopoetics. In the Fantasia, he says this, there is a great field of science. He speaks also of science, philosophy, metaphysics, science. There's a great field of science that is as yet quite close to us. I refer to the science which proceeds in terms of life, a life science, and is established on data of living experience and of sure intuition. Call it subjective science if you like. Our science is a science of the dead world. So he's looking for a science, a knowledge, maybe une connaissance, plutôt qu'une science, but a connaissance of life, a living world. Some of the terminology, some of the vocabulary is a bit specious. How can you be sure that your intuition is sure? But there is, for me, in these quotations, in these sections I've quoted, something essential. Elsewhere in the Fantasia, he says this, to live dynamically from the great source and not statically, like machines driven by ideas and principles, or automatically from one fixed desire. And he speaks of a disease in our world, which is a disease of idealism. The construction of ideas divorced from living life. He hates, his enemy, if you like, is what he calls the theoretic imbecile trying to frustrate and dislocate all life. What Lawrence is after is a new location of life, hence, by the way, his moving from place to place, from one location to another. He's trying to find a new contact, a new location. A new location, a relocation, or if you like, a regrounding of culture, a regrounding of civilization, a regrounding in the first instance of his own life. In his introduction to classic American literature, he speaks of this relocation. He says, for example, the world fears a new experience more than it fears anything, because a new experience displaces so many old experiences. People like just to hold on to their habits of what they consider to be their own little world. Whereas this new experience is a challenge. And some people prefer not to hear the challenge. It is like trying to use muscles, he says, that have never been used or that have been going stiff for ages. The new movement hurts horribly. The world doesn't fear a new idea. It can pigeonhole any idea, but it can't pigeonhole a real new experience. And it's this real new experience that Lawrence tries to put across, tries to get into, first of all, and put across in his poems. What he's after is a self-change, a transformation of himself, because he knows his own self was formed by certain establishments, certain structures, and then, as an extension of this, a world change. But to get at your deep self is the first horrible experience. Getting down to the deepest self, he says, takes some diving. I've been trying to get into Lawrence's thought or his life experience there. And to sum up the sort of approach to this, I think in terms of what Jules Monroe, a sociologist, said of Georges Bataille, the French poet. Monroe says, la pensée de Bataille est une nébuleuse dont son existence est le noyau. That applies admirably to D.H. Lawrence. His thought is a kind of nebula a cluster of energy, if you like, the center of which is his existence. And it's an existence in perpetual change, in perpetual metamorphosis. So it's hard to fix his thought. You cannot, in fact, fix his thought. It flows like a running river. But there are certain clusters, certain formations in the nebula. So at least to get rid of some of the caricatures of Lawrence, Lawrence considered only as the writer of Lady Chatterley's Lover, for example, let's look at some of these clusters. Because Lawrence is not simply Lady Chatterley's lover. He is a lover of truth, of his own truth. This truth he often tried to tie into primitive civilizations like American Indians or Etruscans in Europe. But it's mainly his own truth, and it's a truth going against the current, out with the modes of modernity. The man, Lawrence, here again I'm thinking of a phrase by Monroe describing Bataille, is a kind of quietiste agité. There's a movement from quietism, quiet concentration in lonely spaces, to this movement of world change, this life and world movement. Well, if we sort of try and disengage from the general flow, if only just to change caricatural images, three clusters, I would say that the three clusters worth looking at would be one, something which I'm going to call here cosmic consciousness. The second cluster might be a re-erotization of society. And that doesn't mean Marquis de Sade, you know, eroticism, a re-erotization of society. And then three, a new sense of community. These are the three main movements, I think, in D.H. Lawrence's thought. Cosmic consciousness, re-erotization of society, and a new communitarianism, shall we say. For Lawrence, as for André Breton in France, the primordial contacts between man and the world and the earth had been cut. Man, modern man, is a victim of increasing materialism on the one hand and introverted intellectualism on the other. He's lost touch. He's no longer in touch with the earth, with the universe. And there's a need of a reintegration of his being, a need to try and reestablish a pure relationship with the universe. That is what we'll call cosmic consciousness. As for what I've called re-erotization of society, well, think, for example, of Marcuse's book, Eros et Civilisation, Eros and Civilization. That's exactly the same theme. You know, and it's not a kind of apology for universal Pigalle, right? It's a movement of all the senses in contact with the universe. Most of it concentrating, at least in some of D.H. Lawrence's text, in the sexual relationship. The sexual relationship is perhaps the only place where most people achieve some kind of going beyond their closed-in personality. The only time they experience a kind of opening or a kind of sensual fulfillment. The sexual relationship, for him, is considered as a kind of symbol or image of the total relationship possible. Because the sexual relationship for Lawrence, and this is the theme of many of his novels, can also become stifling, it can become too narrow, if you don't have the sense of the larger contact. What he hates is, in our civilization, the ideology of love. You know, love at every street corner, all these corny songs, je t'aime tu m'aimes, all this stuff. What he's after is a kind of super personal sense of erotic contact. Sometimes he uses biblical imagery for that. Sometimes he speaks of the resurrection of the flesh, which is biblical. Sometimes he speaks in terms of archaic myth, Greek myth, and he speaks of phallic gods. But the idea is, the fundamental idea is, to find a way back into the primordial contact. The third cluster, I would disengage from the general nebula, is this sense of a new community. A desire in Lawrence for taking its basis from a union between man and woman, a desire for a union of more than one or more than two, a society, a community. And he has dreams of this throughout his life. I don't think you can speak of it in terms of politics. It's not so much a political or socio-political move. What he's after is something that resembles more a kind of initiatic society, an initiation group, a community founded on a religion of life. That's his idea. In the Fantasia, he says, we have to get back to the great purpose of manhood, a passionate mission in actively making a world. Well, it's ideas like these that come across, I think, in the following poems. One of them, The Swan. Look at this poem then, The Swan, which is a reactualization of the Greek myth of Leda and the swan. The swan as cosmic energy, as eroto-cosmic energy, if you like, creating a turbulence in the sky. There's a kind of apocalyptic thing in D.H. Lawrence. Apocalypse as destruction of structures, but also as a new revelation. A turbulence in the sky caused by this wild swan, and also, at the same time, a disruption in human affairs. The whole thing leading to a re-erotization, re-cosmicization of the world. Swan. Far off, at the core of space, at the quick of time, beats and goes still the great swan upon the waters of all endings, the swan within vast chaos, within the elements. For us, no longer he swims calmly, nor clacks across the forces furrowing a great gay trail of happy energy. Nor is he resting passive upon the atoms, nor flying north desolative icewards to the sleep of ice, nor feeding in the marshes, nor honking norn-like into the twilight. But he stoops now in the dark upon us. He is treading our women, and we men are put out as the vast white bird furrows our featherless women with unknown shocks and stamps his black marsh feet on their white and marshy flesh. I'm using then as the Greek myth of Leda and the swan, you might call some of D.H. Lawrence's thought mythopoeic thought. Huh? Mythopoeic thought, reactualizing ancient myths. And this swan, as I say, as a concentration of energy, apparently more in contact with the women and with the men. Or let's say that in Lawrence's opinion here, at least in this poem, the women would be more in contact with this erotic cosmic energy than the men of our particular civilization. Far off, at the core of space, at the quick of time, beats and goes still the great swan upon the waters of all endings, the swan within vast chaos, within the elements. A word that comes up again and again in Lawrence is this word quick. Quick, not meaning simply fast, but the quick as being the livest section, the livest part, like the quick of the nail. Far off at the core of space, right at the heart of the cosmos, at the quick of time, at the center of time and space, beats. There's always a sense of beating, palpitation in D.H. Lawrence, and goes still. There's the beat and the quietness, the great swan upon the waters of all endings. This is the kind of apocalyptic thing. The swan within vast chaos, within the elements. And following the same line, the same wavelength, if you like, you can look at the poem Bavarian Gentians. Bavarian Gentians, they also concentrate energy. The white swan is a white concentration of energy, if you like. The gentian is a blue concentration of energy. This probably was D.H. Lawrence's last poem. If you like, it's his death poem, written in the south of France. Again, reactualization of ancient myth. He's referring to the underworld, as seen in Greek terms. And as with the poem of the almond tree, you have Lawrence coming in again and again at these things, at these flowers, at these gentians, trying to get as much out of them as possible. Trying to see them finally as guides into the earth, into the underworld, where this primordial contact, this primeval contact he's after all the time, may be realized. Bavarian Gentians. Not every man has gentians in his house in soft September, that slow, sad Michaelmas. Bavarian gentians, big and dark, only dark, darkening the daytime torchlight with the smoking blueness of Pluto's gloom, ribbed and torchlike with their blaze of darkness spread blue down, flattening into points, flattened under the sweep of white day, torch flower of the blue smoking darkness, Pluto's dark blue days, black lamps from the halls of Dio, burning dark blue, giving off darkness, blue darkness, as Demeter's pale lamps give off light. Lead me then, lead me the way. Reach me a gentian, give me a torch. Let me guide myself with the blue forked torch of this flower down the darker and darker stars, where blue is darkened on blueness, even where Persephone goes just now from the frosted September, to the sightless realm where darkness is awake upon the dark, and Persephone herself is but a voice, or a darkness invisible enfolded in the deeper dark of the arms of Pluto, and pierced with the passion of dense gloom, among the splendor of torches of darkness, shedding darkness on the lost bride and her groom. It's very much like what you have in the Egyptian Book of the Dead or the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the poem which accompanies the dead man on his first travels in the underworld. It's D.H. Lawrence's poem of the dead and written for himself. Lawrence's writing, as is obvious, I think, from these excerpts, is very much concerned with sheer autobiography and sheer self-expression. He is concerned with expressing himself, getting as much out of himself as he can, getting all the juice out, if you like. He says in a letter of 1912, "It is so much oneself, one's naked self. I give myself away so much and write what is my most palpitant, sensitive self." And in another letter, 1928, he comes back on this idea of the self, because he says there are several levels of the self, and the self he wants to get at is the deepest self, what he calls the demonic self. He wants to get at the demon, the daimon, as Socrates said, the deepest self, the most energetic self. A young man is afraid of his demon and puts his hand over the demon's mouth sometimes and speaks for him. And the things the young man speaks are rarely poetry. So I have always tried to let the demon say his say. In another letter, 1913, he says this, "I have always tried to get the emotion out in its own course without altering it. It needs the finest instinct imaginable, much finer than the skill of the craftsman. That Japanese Yoni Noguchi tried it. He doesn't quite bring it off. Often I don't, sometimes I do. Sometimes Whitman is perfect. Remember, skilled verse is dead in 50 years. This reference to Whitman we've seen again and again in these poets we're concerned with. Whitman as beginning this thing we're trying to explore. And there you have Lawrence speaking against all kinds of perfect verse, the poet artisan, and speaking in terms of instinct, emotion, energy. I have always try to get an emotion out in its course without altering it. Skilled verse is dead in 50 years. But the most complete expression of D.H. Lawrence's ideas in poetry, his largest statement of poetic theory, if you like, is the preface to his American edition of New Poems, 1919. This is the preface to the American edition then of the New Poems. There he makes a distinction between two types of poetry, first of all. He says there's poetry that speaks of the past, and he takes as example the Iliad in Greek poetry, speaking of past events, or Keats in Romantic England, speaking of the past. There's the voice of the past, and there's the voice of the future, when he gives the example of Odysseus in Greece, and Shelley for English literature. The Iliad and Keats on the one hand, then, the poetry of the past, the voice of the past, and the voice of the future, Odysseus or Shelley. And he says, the poetry of the past, like the poetry of the future, can be immaculate, perfect, and complete. It's possible to write a complete poetry of the past, and it's possible to write a complete, perfect poetry of the future. But you cannot write a perfect poetry of the present. The present is much more confused, much more complex. There's another kind of poetry, he says, the poetry of that which is at hand, the poetry of the immediate present. In the immediate present, there is no perfection, no consummation, nothing finished. The strands are all flying, quivering. This poetry of the present, then, is a poetry of the beat, the present beat, poetry of flight, poetry of quivering, poetry of palpitation, not perfect, not consummate, not complete. Something which is trying to be much better than fine verse. Something which is trying to express the finer moments, the more subtle moments of a life. And looking at a rose, as we saw in William Carlos Williams, D.H. Lawrence cannot see the rose simply as a static thing to be admired or to be contemplated. He says the perfect rose is only a running flame. The perfect rose is a running flame, emerging and flowing off. It emerges from the earth and it flows off into nothingness, emerging and flowing off, and never in any sense at rest, static or finished. Herein lies its transcendent loveliness. The loveliness of life consists in arising from an unknown, enjoying one's moment of complete presence, if you like, and then moving into another unknown. That's how he sees life. That's how he'd like his poem to be. The whole tide of all life and all time suddenly heaves like a wave and appears before us as an apparition, a revelation. We look at the very white quick of nascent creation. The rising of a wave and then its fall into foam. The whole tide of all life and all time suddenly heaves and appears before us as an apparition, a revelation of sheer naked life. We look at the very white quick, the word's coming in again, the very white quick of nascent creation. He wants to get at creation at its birth moment, not seeing it as something dead to be described, but as something to be lived from within and to be spoken about from within. He speaks of, in another beautiful phrase, the still white seething, the incandescence of the incarnate moment. There must be mutation, he says, swifter than iridescence, haste, not rest, come and go, not fixity, inconclusiveness, immediacy, the quality of life itself, without denouement or finish. And he says again, Whitman's is the best poetry of this kind. Life surging itself into utterance, into expression, from its very wellhead. That's the source and the inspiration of D.H. Lawrence. That's what he's after. This, obviously, this radical move, this primal inspiration, has an effect on the form of the poems, has an effect on the prosody, shall we say. Lawrence, as you've already seen, writes never in any of the established forms. The established forms are completely thrown out the window. And he says himself that the poetry of the instant present, which is after, cannot have the same body. He uses the word body. There's a kind of physicality of speech, physicality of the word. Cannot have the same body or the same motion, body and movement, as the poetry of the before and after, the poetry of the past, the poetry of the future. He wants poetry that has a body in movement, a body of words in movement. He says that most poetry which does not respect the established forms is merely a kind of hodgepodge or a kind of slipshod anything at all. It breaks up the lovely form of metrical verse and presents mere bits and pieces of fragments under the title of Vers Libre, Free Verse. This, he says, is what most of those who abandon metrical verse dish up. This is what most so-called free versifiers, vers libristes, accomplish. But for D.H. Lawrence, free verse should be something else. In fact, if it's real verse, it's never absolutely free, because it's going to be in touch with elements, it's going to be in touch with forces. Free verse, in Lawrence's sense of the word, has its own nature. There is neither star nor pearl, but instantaneous, like plasm. Free verse, in Lawrence's vocabulary, is or should be direct utterance from the instant. Always these words, direct or immediate. Direct utterance from the instant, whole man. This sense also of the whole man, wholly attentive to the wholeness of reality. It is the soul and the mind and the body surging at once, nothing left out. It is the soul and the mind and the body, the totality of life, surging at once, always these strong surging verbs, surging at once, nothing left out. Well, obviously, this kind of thing is difficult. It depends on sheer absolute spontaneity, and it may rarely succeed 100%. Lawrence himself says there is some confusion, some discord. But the confusion and the discord, he defends this confusion and discord, the confusion and the discord belong to the reality, as noise belongs to the plunge of water. There will be a certain amount of noise in the poem, a certain amount of confusion, but you take that in the movement, just as a river flowing will carry along with it a certain amount of debris, just as a tide coming in will carry a lot of flotsam and jetsam, which you will leave out in a perfect poem, but which in this kind of poem you will carry along with you. The main thing being that the poem should have its movement, its surge, its upsurge. Nothing ever prescribed. There's no model to follow. No models whatsoever, no prescription. In free verse, we look for the insurgent naked throb of the instant moment. In free verse, we look for the insurgent naked throb, naked is a word which is coming up again and again, of the instant moment. To break the lovely form of metrical verse is not enough in itself. The utterance of the new poetry must be like a spasm, a naked contact with all influences at once, enjoying as many influences as possible. It doesn't want to get anywhere, it just takes place. It has no message to carry, if you like, but it opens a space. It is a place which opens a space of present, immediate sensation, immediate life. The law must come fresh each time. There are no prescribed laws. The law must come fresh each time from within. And just as before, he gave the example of the rose, which he saw not as a static object, but as a running flame. Now he's going to give his image of the bird. The law is like a bird on the wing, like a bird in flight. The bird is on the wing in the winds, flexible to every breath, a living spark in the storm, its very flickering depending upon its supreme mutability and power of change. In free verse, the law must come fresh each time from within. The bird is on the wing in the winds, flexible to every breath, a living spark in the storm, its very flickering depending upon its supreme mutability and power of change. To be in perpetual change, a complete and utter and permanent metamorphosis. Such, for Lawrence, is the rare new poetry. And he concludes his excursion into poetics with the idea we had at the beginning of this lecture, terra incognita. There is an unknown country we do not know much of yet. Such is the rare new poetry, one realm we have never conquered, the pure present. One great mystery of time is terra incognita to us, the instant. It would be possible here to speak in terms of Bachelard's Métaphysique de l'instant, where he says that la poésie est une métaphysique instantanée. That's very, very close to D.H. Lawrence. Just as we could speak of Bachelard's idea of a depth psychology, a new depth psychology, which would be concerned with total presence. Bachelard speaks of le principe d'une simultanéité essentielle où l'être le plus dispersé, le plus désuni, conquiert son unité. And in another text by Bachelard, which is called La Poétique du Phoenix, the Phoenix, which is D.H. Lawrence's bird, Bachelard says, il est réservé à quelques poètes solitaires de vivre en état de métamorphose permanente. I think D.H. Lawrence was a poet who lived this permanent metamorphosis, this permanent vital change. Well, there's a lot to be done in this field. There's a lot to be done to deepen the experience, to improve the expression, and to get the whole thing recognized. There are three stages in the process. Deepen the poetic experience itself, improve the expression of it, poetically and theoretically, and then, thirdly, socially, get the whole thing recognized as something essential, vital, necessary. So a lot of work to be done in the field, but this morning, let's just, to finish up, take a look at a rainbow. The rainbow as seen by D.H. Lawrence. The rainbow. Even the rainbow has a body made of the drizzling rain and is an architecture of glistening atoms, built up, yet you can't lay your hand on it, nay, nor even your mind. And when I come to the end of that poem, even the rainbow has a body made of the drizzling rain, yet you can't lay your hand on it, nay, nor even your mind, what comes into my mind is a phrase from an Indian text, which says this, that where there is no place to fix the mind, there is the great gesture. Where there is no place to fix the mind, there is the great gesture. That's what we're after. Moving the mind as far as it can go, trying to disengage the place, the space for the supreme poetic gesture.